G'day everyone, it's Ian here, and it's the last webinar of the year. So it will be, there's a few questions that have come in, and we'll go through them and work from that. Now I know that you can also write your questions in the question box down there, and send them to me, and I can answer them as well. So as I said, last one for the year. Festive season. There's still a few people on here, so that's a good thing. So Dipna is, where is she? Somewhere in Austria at the moment, I think. She might even be in Denmark now. So she's having a good time. And I see pictures of her in the snow and having a good ski around with her kids and stuff. So let's get started on the questions. And we'll start from up here. So I will start with I am a plumber and builder by trade. What I say here is simply going to be an opinion of my learning and what I know. That may not necessarily be true. It'll be of general nature, and you need to go and get qualified advice from those people that are qualified to give it to you. So don't go and make any decisions tomorrow, going on what I've said tonight. Make sure you get good representation from people that are qualified to give that to you. That's why Dimpna set up the network, so that you've got access to lots of those people. All right, let's start with hi, Ian and Dimpna. At the beginning of the year, I set up two trusts with two corporate trustees on top for each one, as I was planning to buy two different properties. Then I end up changing my strategy and bought just one renovation, subdivision, and development. Very good, because there's multiple strategies there. I bought this only one property using one of these trusts last month. Now I'm in the process of subdividing. I'll sell the existing property, build to the rear and keep it. I will need to distribute profits of the sale. Can I distribute to the unused trust that did not buy anything yet? Thanks in advance. Well, there's a couple of things that you've got to think about here. I will tell you that the distribution to another trust would be useless to you, simply because the trust hasn't done anything. There's no losses in it, so it can't take up the loss. In which case, the distribution you will distribute by the end of the financial year to yourself or an associated entity. So really, when you do a distribution, it's going to be yourself or three generations around you. Sorry, it's going to be to the beneficiaries or three generations around the beneficiaries, or an associated structure, which would be your bucket company. So you could distribute to the bucket company and pay company tax, or you could distribute to yourself. Now, remember, with all of this, if you're going to do a distribution, you've actually made money, so don't concern yourself about paying tax. We want to pay lots of tax because that means you're earning lots of money. This is the thing with development, though. You know, it's going to be, and the downfall of self-employed people is that when they collect $100, they think $100 is theirs, and it's not. You know, we've got to give some up to the Australian Taxation Office to help fund. Oh, geez, I'm not going to say it, but you probably all know what I'm thinking. I would say that to start with. The second thing I would also say is that you are subdividing. You're probably going to be lending to your trust structure from yourself, and there'll be a loan in place between yourself and the trust, and you'll be taking that off and buying the property, and you'll need to put the deposits and the stamp duty costs in, whatever. When you sell the front property, you can talk to your accountant about how you would value the front property and how it would work to your advantage, not to have, how do I say this diplomatically, to have the figures set up so that the capital gain would be mostly on the rear property rather than the front property. So, and generally that would be a true thing anyway. Let's say you did buy that with that property that you have bought. Once you've done a renovation to it, and you've spent money on it, it's quite likely that you're going to sell it for under what you paid for the entire property anyway. So I'll give you an example. If you bought one for $300,000 and you spent $50,000 on a renovation, it now owes you $350 plus the stamp duty. So your capital base, your capital cost base, would be up above the $350 mark. when you went and subdivided off and then you went and sold the front block, it's probably quite likely that you're either going to sell it for around 350 or just under 350. So technically, you haven't made a capital gain on the front. Though on the back block, you own a block of land now that you got for, you know, next to nothing, let's say 20, 30, 40 grand, and it might be worth $150,000. So it's not until you sell that property that you actually made a gap capital gain. So what would happen is you would sell the front house, you would go off and pay yourself back because you've lent money to the trust to buy it as a deposit, and some costs and stamp duties. You would, you know, be able to refinance the block and pay yourself back on the sale of the front property. You'd have to pay a bank back as well, and then set up a new loan on the rear property. So it's quite unlikely that unless you've picked up a really fantastic deal that you would be paying capital gains on the front anyway to start with, especially when you can get professional advice around your finance and accounting people to give you the right valuation at that time. Hi Dimpna, I'm based in Sydney looking to buy a property in Brisbane. Because I'm not a big fan of townhouse and apartment and not extremely keen on standard low yield home, I've been looking at students' accommodation and block of units. I've been following your strategy in subdivision, rando, granny flat in Sydney and invested in a mining town as well, but not sure on the best strategy for Brisbane. So let's start with the block of units. Most block of units I'm looking for are under 2 mil have been illegally subdivided. I'm not sure what that means by illegally subdivided. Probably chopped up is what you're saying. There are no such things as granny flats that can legally be rented separately except in Ipswich. All right. Well, I'll just correct you on that one. Granny flats now can be built and rented to another party on the same block. So you can have two leases in Ipswich, in Logan, in Toowoomba, in Moreton Bay, Sunshine Coast. I heard recently of Rockhampton, I think, and Townsville possibly as well. They are all changing. So, though, when it comes to Brisbane, all the agents have been advising that this is standard practice in Brisbane. Well, I can tell you in Brisbane that they definitely will not allow it, and you will get hammered if you try and do it. So, and when I call the council with specific property, the advice was can't comment until we've sent a council rep to inspect the property and it'll cost you $550. It seemed to me, based on the rule, it is illegal, but the council was not very black and white in the advice. Well, I can tell you quite simply, if it's Brisbane City Council, they are dead set against dual occupancies at this stage, but they will change. So I've always said that if you're going to build something in Brisbane, build it with an internal granny flat that is still part of the house. So I'm talking about building a 5-bedroom house sort of thing. That has a granny flat that is simply just a door at the bottom of the stairs or whatever it is, and you wouldn't rent it to two different parties. You just rent it as a 5-bedder. Or if you're in Brisbane City Council, you could rent by the room up to 5 occupants or occupants or unrelated parties. Come the time where Brisbane will, and there will be a time where Brisbane will say, okay, we're missing out on charges here. We could actually get more money. How about we approve granny flats? You make sure that you've built it, that house with a granny flat that has the fire rating already put in place, so it's simplified paperwork. That's my plan, I think. Okay, I've even found a property that has been approved to have granny flats built, but to rent it separately is still a grey area. Again, Brisbane City Council won't let you rent it to anyone other than a family member, and you will have to sign a stat deck to say that it is a family member living in there and paying rent. So, you know, I don't like the use of the word granny flats. I like, you know, some New South Wales have now tried to move away from the words granny flat and gone to secondary dwelling. You've got ancillary dwellings, auxiliary dwellings. You know, there's lots of different names. And so granny flats were built in days gone past simply for the older grandparents, and we've moved on from that. So, it is a grey area in some points, but, you know, definitely in Darwin, Northern Territory, you're now allowed to have a granny flat up to 50 square metres. In WA, up to 70 square metres, and you can rent it to separate parties. So lots of places are moving. Victoria, I read an article recently, is having pressure put on them too, and they will start soon to approve as well. So can you share, if I acquire these type of property, what is the risk? Okay, well, if you acquire a property that's illegal, and you get normal standard insurance cover, you are at risk. You are going to, you know, put yourself in a position that's not good. So if you're going to buy one of these property, you want to get insurance that covers you. You want to get it in writing that what you're being covered for. None of this, read the product disclosure statement and they tell you over the phone that you're covered. Insurance company's job is to collect premiums and not pay out. That's how they'll make money. So make sure you always get it in writing. In general, is there any way I can make it legal? Well, yes, you do an application through your town planner, like you're saying there. And private town planners are the most important people that you will be using when it comes to this sort of stuff. You can use certifiers as well, but a private town planner will really know this stuff. So if you do buy something illegal, just remember that you may not be able to make it legal. It just may not make the rules. You might make it a condition of your purchase that once it becomes approved and legal, that you can go through with the purchase. Student accom seems to be a good one, except that it's harder to get a loan and that it's only limited to 5 unrelated people without council approval. Okay, so with student accommodation, you will get loans if you're just doing the 5 unrelated people in there, right? Because it's just a standard house. When you want to go into a commercial arrangement where you've got approval for student accommodation, you're now looking at probably a 30% to 40% deposit. So they'll only fund a 60 to 70% loan to value ratio, LVR, and that's where it becomes commercial. Now, not only that, you're going to have shown 2 years of experience, so 2 years of tax returns, that you know this style of accommodation, that you've managed it before a bank will even look at you. So it's probably an area that I wouldn't go down starting up, unless you're going to do it as the smaller style where you don't need the approval and you can go for the 5 unrelated parties. So based on my calculation with higher insurance, manager fees, electricity bills, it seems to me, unless it is above 10 rooms, it's not so attractive. I would agree with you on that. Can you share your view, any risks which I've moved above? I've spoken a little bit about it, like the commercial thing's a big thing. Have you got any experience with specially built student accommodation? Yeah, well, I've got a little bit. We have gone down that path. I would suggest that you try and keep it under 12 occupants and under 299 square metres of internal floor space, because once you go above that, you're now talking a different class of building, different fire rating. New South Wales and Victoria are probably, Victoria is the easiest to be able to do it, to get your 10 habitable rooms in. New South Wales state government is the next easiest as far as assisting boarding houses to be built. If you Google new generation boarding houses, so that's new generation boarding house fact sheet in New South Wales, you will come up with some incentives that they will give you in New South Wales. If you produce new rooms in New South Wales, they'll give you $2,000 per room for the first 5 years of you letting it out, as long as you have people that are in there for longer than 3 months at a time. So lots of different incentives around the country, but definitely it starts with Victoria being the easiest to get approvals and converting, then it goes to New South Wales and then probably Queensland after that. And I've answered that last bit too. So I've got a question that's come in. Ian, a question. With shared accommodation, will it be more beneficial in New South Wales? I'm thinking with attached toilet, a little kitchen let without any cooking facility. To minimise cost, I will have shared kitchens and shared bathrooms. I've spoken with a few local agents about the rental potential. They could not give me fair advice as there is hardly any stock available. I agree, they find it difficult. What are your thoughts? Should I include bathroom each room and cooking facility with each room or use shared? So I just talked about the New South Wales laws there, Pankaj. So it's probably worthy of you doing some investigation into the New South Wales laws. If you don't give them a self-contained room, so that is a cooking facility and bathroom, you won't be able to get some of those incentives that I'd mentioned. Michael and Sarah, who are your coaches, I'll answer on their behalf. We have a property that's been rented out for the last 7 years. We have subdivided into 2 blocks. I've been made redundant, now only work as casual. We would like to build on the block using my superannuation money and rent out the house when completed. The rent received to go and go back into my super fund, so when I'm ready to retire, we could sell the properties. I'll have little more in my super fund than at the current rate of contribution. I think you're going to have a few issues here. Now, I am not for a second going to talk about Super in great detail because it is such a such an area of control, and I don't have her online. So I would suggest to you that what you are considering to do there, you probably can't do legally with your super fund. You can do joint ventures with your super fund, but that's for someone else to give you advice on. The best person that I could talk to you, that I could send you to, Nigel, is, let me pull it up here. Try and find it for you. So if you go to your ultimate website, oh, damn. I've got funny fingers today. Oh, ultimate. So if you go to the website and you work your way across to the right-hand side tabs, you've got, let me log in. If you go across to your contacts, in your contacts area there, you've got Investor Loans Network, Investor Accounting Network. And in Investor Accounting Network, you have Clint that can help you out. And also, that's in New South Wales. You've also got Tasha in Queensland on the sunny coast that can help out as well. Now, it doesn't matter where they are. Just give them a phone call. Ask them what you're trying to do, and they will be able to help you out with what you're suggesting here. I would suggest that there is possibility that you do something, but it's going to have to be a self-made super fund, and you're going to have to do it correctly so that you don't lose half of it in penalties. Can you recommend the best way to manage my tax records, as this is the first year I've had to complete a tax return with owning a property in a trust? After completing a property deal that involved subdividing and selling a block of land, I now find myself stalled and unable to move forward till my tax has been completed. Well, you know, Paul, that would be regardless of whether you do it, whether you do your own tax or whether you do an assets, a corporate trustee and trust taxes. You've got to get your tax done. I mean, that's obvious that a financer is not going to give you money unless you've got your tax done usually. That's unless, you know, obviously if you're a salary worker, you can show pay slips, but, you know, you're going to have to do your tax. Quite simply, it's no different to how you would do if you would do your normal tax. You would go to a bookkeeper who would get stuff ready to you if you choose to use a bookkeeper, or you would go straight to an accountant. If you use a bookkeeper, you then go on to your accountant. Again, the Investor Accounting Network is the people that you want to talk to. They can handle it. They do it every day. So what happens with the taxes is that you will come towards the end of the financial year. I like to look at April, that gives me 2 months. We look across all our structures and we say, where's money sitting? Where is it that we want to distribute to? How? Where's the taxes coming from? Where's the money coming from? And then we talk to our accountant and they put it together and then do our tax returns. And so for each entity that you own will have and lodge its own individual tax returns. And it'll be the same as you would do as your one as well. So, you know, the company will do a zero return because it's not done any trading, and the trust will then go off and have its bit in there. So for you, you've obviously, if you've sold those two properties, hopefully you've made some money. There's going to be some distribution you now need to look at to where that's going to be distributed to, whether you distribute to your bucket company or whether you go somewhere else. You know, is up to your accountant and you when you decide in April. And the reason I say April is because it gives you 2 months to be able to strategically put your money in the right places. You don't want money sitting in your trust bank account at the end of the financial year without any distributions happening because you'll get charged 46 cents in the dollar. Good morning. I have a question regarding capital gains tax and main residence exemption. Have received many conflicting views. What is correct, please? So you bought a house in February 2001, lived in it until May 2013. Okay, well, quite clear from 2001 to 2013, no capital gains. I bought a new house in April 2013 and moved into it in May 2013. Rented first house in June 2013. So just remember that as far as PPR is concerned, you can have 6 months of crossover. You can have two PPRs and 6 months of crossover. Now renovating the first house because the tenants ruined it and selling it in January 2015. Can I choose which house I want to claim main resident exemption on? Does this fall under the 6-year rule? Well, you can have the second house that you bought. Look, again, you're going to have to get advice on this, okay? So, I would suggest, well, let me read the rest of it. My accountant said I can't and must pay capital gains from April 2013. What happens if I didn't get it valued in April 2013? Well, if you didn't get it valued, what you do is you get a real estate agent to give you current market values of what it would have been in 2013 in April, and a couple of those that will be able to do that will help you out. Now, obviously, if you do have to pay capital gain, then you might want to talk to your real estate agent about what the value of the property was when you moved out. And if you did have to pay capital gains, and that's what the advice was, then you would want the value on your first house to be quite high, if you want to read between the lines there, because the higher the valuation at the time, the less technical money you would have had to pay tax on, if that makes sense. I don't think, though, I think that you do have a choice of what you use as your main residence. It's just that obviously you wouldn't be able to use it. So if you've claimed any taxes on it as being an investment property because you had a renter in there, well, I think it's quite clear that you've made a decision. So that's going to be that. So it could be that your accountant has claimed some taxes as an investment property, in which case you've already made the decision by your tax return. But you can choose which house it is. So I don't know your full circumstances. Again, Tasha and Clint are definitely the people to talk to when it comes down to that. Though, well, like I said, it comes down to how you treated the first house when you moved out of it. If you put a tenant in it and you claimed tax exemptions of some sort, then as an investment property, then it would be quite likely that you've already shown the tax department what you were doing. So there's a question that's come in from Pankaj. It's just Google new generation boarding house fact sheet, and that will give you some understanding around that. There is some subsidies around, but you need to start with from that to start with, Pankaj. Hi, just wondering if you could explain the proposed rental bill before Parliament in Queensland, its ramifications for our older renovated units. How will this affect us? And bad it reads because it's so vague. It appears as though no landlords should have older properties. Kind regards. Well, the fact that you said it's a proposed rental bill is probably the more important thing, because there's many things that go up before Parliament and many things that don't get through. One thing that I can say is that if you go back to the last webinar that Dipna and I did 2 weeks ago, she has she, we had Calvin on to start the webinar, and he went through the changes of what was going on in Queensland as far as property is concerned and the legalities of buying and purchasing. That all could wrap into this one as well. But I would say quite simply that because it's proposed, we should just wait till it comes out. Definitely, it's always a concern if it goes against the landlords, but at the same token, I don't think it's going to be a big issue. I would think that many politicians have their own properties as investment properties, and they wouldn't want to see themselves at the bad end of the stick. So rest easy on that one, I think. Hi, Dipna. Merry Christmas to you and the team. I have a block of land in New South Wales that has been purchased under a trust with a corporate trustee. It is the only property or business that the entity conducts. The corporate trustee is not used for anything else. To my surprise, I was recently issued with a land tax assessment notice. The value of the land, according to the Office of State Revenue, is only 110, well below the land tax threshold of 432. My previous understanding was that this block of land would not be subject to land tax, since it is well below the threshold, but the land tax assessment is 1.6%, obviously suggests otherwise. Okay, the key thing here is that it's New South Wales. So New South Wales and Victoria, any property held in trust is taxed from land tax from dollar one. There is no threshold when it comes to that, unless you have a heritage listed property or something like that where they give you some discount on it. So generally, most property, 95% of it, will have land tax subject to it in New South Wales or Victoria from dollar one when you buy in trust. Now you might say, well, that then I, you know, now I've, because I've bought in trust, I've got this tax bill that I have to pay for. And I always say the same thing to people. I am not willing, remembering we've got a few New South Wales, quite a few New South Wales properties, I am not willing to give up my asset protection for the sake of land tax. I can tell you that. I would much rather pay the tax and know that I'm protected, that someone can't take my property and the full value of it. So just be wary of that. So I think I've answered that. It is from $1, and you can go from there. The webinar from 2 weeks ago hasn't been put on the website yet. Do you know when it might be? Well, they're all gone on holiday, so it's quite possible that it won't get on there. Let me have a quick look at it. If not, it will be early. It'll be midway through. It'll be midway through January that you will have to wait for that to come up on. Yeah, so it hasn't been put up yet. You're correct. So yeah, look, it's probably likely to be around the mid of January when they're back at work at Knowledge Source. So Dimna and I don't put it up. We just send it to them and they put it up. Just got another question here. Hi, and I've set up a corporate trust but yet to purchase my investment property. ASIC has sent me the annual company statement review fee invoice. How is the annual fee calculated? How will this fee change when I have purchased my investment property? I don't think the fee stays the same. It's just a calculation on a generalized company that you've set up. And, you know, it is what it is. It's just the same fee every year, I'm pretty sure. It's probably a better question for my wife, Christine, who handles it all, but I'm pretty sure that is just a general fee across the board for the registration of the company. Okay, let's go back here. Oh, that was the last question there. Well, unless you guys send some questions in, we're not going to answer anymore, which means I can go and take an early mark, and we're only half an hour into the webinar. So I would, if you've got some questions, pop them in. Doesn't matter what it is. If you pay 10 years in advance, that is locked. Are you making a statement there, Pankaj, or you're just saying that, are you asking the question? So, yes, so it is locked in. So Pankaj is saying that you can pay 10 years of fees in advance and it's locked in. I don't know whether much savings is going to be. Obviously, they're going to have annual increases depending on CPI and all the rest of it. Though, you know, we just pay them on a yearly basis. So when you're typing the question in, never hit return, because as soon as you hit return, it sends me whatever you've written and all I get is hi, Ian, or hi. So just type it all on one line. Just keep typing and working it through. So unless people were just saying hi to me and because you're nice people. So I've got no questions. Maybe some of the platinums can throw something in. Here we go. All right, now we got it. This is from Andre. If you're building a future granny flat in Brisbane, how do you build that? What is the size? Hi, Brendan. I believe that you should probably, because you never know what a standard across the country is around the 60 square meters, though there is a few areas that have gone 50 square meters. So I would be building something around the 50 square meter mark that's incorporated into the house. So that doesn't include outdoor area. Simply 50 square meters of internal floor space is what you should be aiming at, because you've got things like Northern Territory and Ipswich that are building at 50 square meters. I couldn't see them asking for less than 50 square meters, so I would build them about 50. I hope that sort of answers your question. For Milan, what is the shortest settlement time in New South Wales? Is it compulsory to wait for 28 days once we get building person report and get finance approved? Can we settle? Absolutely. You could settle. If you've got cash, you can settle in a day. I've had a transaction that's gone in a day. So, you know, you just decide that you want to do it. You transfer some money and off you're going. So definitely I would say to you that you can make it as short as you want. So you could say, and I couldn't see that the people on the other side, except for bank notification, remembering that if the other side's got a loan on the property, you have to notify the bank they have to notify the bank on the other side, and that can take 14 days or so. So just be very wary of that. But look, you can make it a day or as long as you want. It really doesn't matter. From Regina. Hi, Ian. Where can I find info on strata titling? Who do you go to for permission to strata title a block of units? Where do you start? Well, the first place you've got to start is obviously a private town planner. or a building certifier that will tell you what the rules are. Then you're going to have to go to your council. Your town planner will go to the council. You'll have to involve a surveyor. Some surveyors can do it, though there's very, you, to get a really great one, you'd have to get a really great one, the surveyor that could do everything. But a surveyor draws up the plans. The town planner then puts it into the council. The council then signs it off. You might have some rectification works that you have to do. That gets done. The council then does, or your building certifier does the inspection. The council signs off on it. Your bank is then told about it. It goes to the lands titles office. Lands title office then lifts the and creates separate titles. It goes back to your bank, or and you then settle it. Now you're going to have to involve a legal person in there too. In the quantum, when we do quantum at Extreme, which now at Fast Profits, we do a whole section on strata titling, and the step A to step B, based to step A to step Z on how to do the strata titling, and there's lots of information in that 2-day event. So with the granny flats, if you are building, when you are building an in-built granny flat that can't be approved at this stage but might be down the track, you just rent it as a normal house, or you would rent it with a head lease in place, or you would rent it to separate people as unrelated parties. Now remember, as unrelated parties across the country, I'm not gonna answer any questions around this. I'm gonna make this statement. There are 560 council areas across the country. Each one of them looks at unrelated parties differently. Each state looks at unrelated parties differently. And if you put tenants in, so you take bond money, it could change completely. An unrelated party means different things across the country as well. So you really need to do your research in your area so that you understand what you're doing and that you're being compliant, 100% compliance. If you think that you can get away with something illegal, I've said it before, I'm saying it quite bluntly, you're an idiot, right? Don't try and do things illegal in property. It will come and bite you on the bum. From James Beer. Hello, sir. Regarding the secondary dwelling size, isn't there an upper limit? In New South Wales, it must be less than 60. Absolutely. So what I'm saying is that there are areas that it has to be less than 50. So you don't know when the council or a state is going to decide what they want, what size. I can't see that they would do anything under 50. So, which case, with good design, under 50 square meters, you can do a half decent two better. And in New South Wales, for example, you can do 60 square meters is the largest you can do. Then you can add 12 square meters of under roof space, decking space, and you can add a shed and a garage to the property as well. So it can be more than that. Though that's where it's going to end up. So, for example, and again, WA has 70 square meters. So 70 square meters, you can build a 3-bedroom house. Like, that's ridiculous. You can build a 4-bedroom house, I reckon, in 70 square meters. It'd be tight, but you can do it. From Karen, I've spoken with a few builders in WA and asked them about building a granny flat under one roof. They're not understanding what I'm talking about. How should I explain this? I reckon find a builder that actually knows what you're talking about. It's quite simple. You just have to say to a builder, I want to build a very large home, but incorporated into that home, I want to build a granny flat in one corner of the house. So whether it be the front corner or back corner, and you want to make sure that it's done so that there's a 60-minute firewall between the granny flat and the house. Now, if you incorporate it and it's not in WA, you can get them approved. There's no problem. If it was another place that doesn't have granny flats approved yet, then all you do is that the granny flat area doesn't have a separate, it has a wet bar, but it doesn't have a cooking facility. So it's just a sink. And you then have a door that's internal to the property. You make sure that that door down the track can simply be closed up and fire rated when they do go to the point where they will approve granny flats. Raymond Holt is giving me a hashtag 308. I'm not sure why, Raymond. If it was 408, that'd be Philip Hughes. But I'm not sure why you gave me that. Geez, I've got some questions now. Okay, just let me open this up a little bit. Do you know how much it costs to get a DA to change a shop to a unit in Sydney? Your private town planners are going to be the one. That's such a big question that I cannot possibly answer. There's going to be so many options that that have to be looked into from your private town planner. It'll come down to lots of stuff like your it'll come down to things like the zoning. It'll come down to the council and what they want to see and the strategic plan they want to see for the area. Lots and lots of stuff to sort out. So go to your council website, see if you can find it under planning and development, the DA trackers or the development application trackers, and find someone in the area that does lots of applications. A private town planner does lots, and then that way you can work from that. Okay. What's the story with Tash and Grow Accounting? Have they joined Investor Accounting? So Tash and Clint are now Investor Accounting Network. So the Investor Accounting Network, or the IAN for short, is now operating across the country. So they have all areas. They've got offices in most states now so that they can help out all the students. They saw that there was a need for that, and that's why they put it together. I have a property in Victoria. Comes under high density, but my street is only one, has a covenant for one dwelling. My area comes under high density, but my street is only one, has covenant for one dwelling. Do you think it's worth to go to VCAT and covenant removed? Yeah, well, depending on what your feedback on the covenant. Remember, some of these covenants are put on properties 50, 100 years ago and don't have any need to be there anymore. So I definitely would be researching whether it's worth lifting the covenant. Again, your private town planner is going to be the one that's going to give you feedback, and VCAT's always a good thing to go for, definitely. Hi, Ian. How to access plans and property information of previous units, houses built in my suburb, Victoria? Victoria is such a bad place to try and get information because of your privacy laws down there. So there are places where you can just Google the street address and hopefully find it. Planning alerts sometimes allows you to find some applications in the local area, but otherwise, you'd have to find private town planners in the area and hopefully they can give you information. But Victoria is really difficult for lots of things when it comes to finding out information because of the privacy laws. Ron's saying is, how do I book in for the 3-day boot camp in Sydney? You simply ring Knowledge Source when they're back on board. I think they're back on the 12th maybe. And when they're back on board, just ring them and tell them that you want to book in for the Sydney boot camp and they will book it in for you. You'll be sent a confirmation letter. Hi, Ian. Would it be possible to get a duplex on a 405 square metre block in Brisbane? Oh, my God, Graham, please. Again, it's going to come down to, I'll say it again, there's 560 councils across the country, and for me to know every rule and regulation in every council with all the plans that they've got within the council is almost impossibility, very difficult for me to answer. That's why I always say a private town planner is going to be the one that's going to tell you whether you can do it or not. Now, remember, 405 square metres, unless it's a low-medium residential block, unlikely. You need to have the correct zoning to do that. You need to know what your zoning is. You need to do all your due diligence around that. Ken, I was considering building two of Kevin Dudney's dual key houses on a block, one to hold and one to sell, pay down debt to make positive. This will be in Queensland. I believe I will need to sublease to rent both, which I am holding. Can you advise on how to go about this? Oh, I just lost that. One second. How to go about this? Any recommendations regarding insurance? Any companies you give better deals or better clauses? Any other thing you might? Again, I explained at the Kevin Dudney Bootcamp how you should be doing that. It's probably not the forum for me to do it here. Definitely when it comes to insurance companies, the one thing I will say is, get it in writing. Tell them what you're doing so that they understand. You might pay more. You probably pay more in premiums, but more importantly, probably go and get an insurance broker to look and tell them what you're doing and ask the insurance broker. Now, if you don't have an insurance broker, again, go to your strategist and tell them that you're looking for a mortgage broker. Sorry, not a mortgage broker, an insurance broker. They are the same as mortgage brokers, except they know the best products in insurance to go for, and they'll make sure that you've got the right insurance, Ken. So that's what you do for the insurance. As far as the renting out to separate people under one title as a head lease, That's something I did discuss during the Dudney boot camp, and you can ask Kevin about that if you need to as a member. With Queensland, what I can say is that if you're within 200 metres of a railway station or a main transport station, you can look up transport orientated developments. So that's the TOD developments, and they will give you a number of different exemptions or increases in allowances to build if you're within 200 metres, because the idea is that obviously they don't need as many cars, so they'll let you do a few more things. From Jennifer, how does a head lease work? Does that enable the tenants to sublease part of it? Yep, absolutely. So that's how a head lease works, and the tenants can do as they wish from that. So you as a landlord. Now, what I'm saying is that you could set yourself up so that you do a head lease to a structure that you own, and that your structure could then find multiple parties to take up residency. I use my words carefully in that property. Jared, can you please give me a quick rundown on the process of negotiating a fixed price contract for building a standard house? I have concept plans now for my TAME architect. I don't know what TAME means, but anyway. A fixed price contract. Well, quite simply, if it's not approved, you're going to have difficulty getting people to give you a fixed price contract, because they're going to want to see some engineering diagrams. So, Jared, when it comes to a fixed price contract, there's a few things I would say to you. Make sure that you read through every single word that's in that contract. Make sure that there is no provisional sums allowed for, because provisional sums, they might say we've allowed $4,500 for toilet fixtures or bathroom fixtures. Well, that could blow out to 10 grand. Make sure that they've allowed for all the costs that you need on the block. So if they have to put 110 metres, when you're reading through the contract and it says we've allowed for 55 linear metres of fencing, and you can guarantee, you sign a contract and the week before they start, they will say, oh, actually, there's another 200 square metres of concrete we need to put in, and there's another 100 metres of linear metres of fencing we've got to put in, and now you have to pay us 20 grand extra. Read through every single word, and if you don't understand it, mark it, and then get your legal person, Pacific Law, to look at the contract so that they're aware of the things that you could get caught on. The other things I say with fixed price contracts is, any contract, is how long it's going to take them to build it. Because for me, I don't think they should be taking any more than 12 weeks. At a pinch, I'll give them 16 weeks. But that'll include rain days. So, you know, the days that where they can't do things because of certain reasons come up and they add it. I've seen building contracts that are longer than a year. I mean, what the hell's going on? How did it take that long to build a house, you know? We've done some fairly major structural builds in 4 to 6 weeks. I don't understand how they can, and the reason is because they farm themselves out to many different clients, and you don't get the full potential look at. So that's why they take it. So I would read it over and over again on a fixed price contract. I would make sure that you get multiple contracts and quotes done. And when you get the multiple quotes, I can guarantee you, you'll ring 20 people, 20 builders, and you'll get 5 back. And out of that 5, there won't be one that will be exactly the same. So you have to make up a matrix of what one includes and what doesn't include. And then you've got to go back to them and say, well, you haven't included fencing. Can you give me the full fencing price? You haven't included this. You haven't included that. Now, you're going to get people that are going to get pissed off with you. Well, they're definitely not the people you want building for you anyway. If they get pissed off because you've asked them to finite a quote, get rid of them. That's what I think. Do I need a separate letterbox for a granny flat when under the one roof? Not if it's not approved for a granny flat, because remember, I'm not suggesting by any stretch of the imagination that you should be putting a separate granny flat and renting it separate if it's not allowed. I'm saying just have forward thinking that in the future it could be done. So you're building it in a way, because it doesn't cost that much more to build it in a way. It means that you will take your power out from that area separately to a switchboard. You won't have a separate meter until the granny flat gets approved down the track, and that way you can do it from there. Hi, Ian. Had destroyed our investment property carpet and left the place in mess. The total bill came to $3,000. The tenant had forfeited their bond of $2,400. Does rental insurance normally charge in excess to make claim? Well, that comes down to your insurance policy. Go back, Eric, and read your insurance policy and find out what your claim is. Make a call to the insurance company. But definitely you would be working in a way where you make sure, for example, most landlord insurance, you would claim, you would do all the internal works. If there's any works to be externally done, you do the bond external, because landlord insurance won't cover you for external works. So always use your bond for external works, and then make sure you use the insurance for the internal works. Okay. In Victoria, there are 6 units on a block that have been built in the 60s. There is a vacant block next to it. Can I use this as a precedent when talking with a council that will help me build at least 6 on the vacant block? I doubt it. Again, why are you talking to the council? You should be talking to a private town planner. You can do a pre-lodgement meeting with the private town planner at the council. You can turn up, but don't say anything. Just listen. And I doubt that you'll be able to use precedent. They took that out a long time ago. Because it was too dangerous for them. I don't think that it would be possible to use precedent, though a private town planner would be able to tell you what you could do on there, and then they could take it to the council and ask some questions to the council and see whether they would consider it at a pre-lodgement meeting. From Sean, I can purchase a property that has 2 houses that can be subdivided. It needs one of the houses to be moved on the block. One of them can have a granny flat. To keep, they are negative in the market in Townsville. The immediate uplift from the subdivision and cosmetic reno is pretty good. However, we were to sell and realise that it would take a few months to sell. It would be nice to keep, but how negative is too negative? For this scenario, it would be $70 per week before tax deductions. Okay. If you're on $200,000 a year, I'm sure $70 a week in negative gearing wouldn't hurt you. But at the same token, if you're on $400 a week and $70 is coming out every week and you don't have a tenant in there for a couple of weeks, all of a sudden you are really starting to hurt. So I would consider that everyone's scenario is different when it comes to negative. Now, you might find a couple of different strategies. You might decide that you are going to sell the property, but you will do it as a rent to buy. So you will find someone, you'll advertise it, and they will pay for it, and that will become a positive geared property that gives them the option to buy it down the track. You might decide that, okay, well, I might find someone that does want to buy it and they can't pay for it right now, but let's give them 6-month rental. I'll make sure that they pay more in rental, and the more that they pay, the $70 more is what I'm going to put on top of the rental, and then they've got the option in 6 months to buy it from me. So that way, at least it's neutral for you. Remember that if you sell part of it and pay down debt on the other stuff, that you are going to be positive from there. So again, Raymond, you did a hashtag 308 hashtag. Not sure what that means. Can you please elaborate what that is? Okay, so for the next webinar, next Q&A webinar, remember you can send questions to questions@realestatesuccess.com.au. That's questions@realestatesuccess.com.au. And that way you can have your questions answered first and we can go through them. So there isn't any more questions, in which case I'm going to call it a night. I want to wish everyone a great Christmas. Have a great new year. Looking forward to another year next year of lots of learning with everyone involved. I am very I'm fortunate to do the things that I do and the position that I hold here, being able to speak to everyone and teach everyone and also learn along the way myself. So thank you, everyone, for a fantastic year. I really appreciate you listening and asking the questions as well, because that benefits everyone. So on behalf of Dimpner and I, have a great Christmas. We'll see you and hear from me early in the new year, and looking forward, like I said before, to another fantastic year. Thanks, everyone, for what you do.